This conference will now be recorded.
All right, there we go. We're recording now. So today is, it's exciting. Today is Wednesday, December 10th. This is the discussion of Herodotus Book 6 with the Herodotus Reading Group for 2014-2015. All right, so we'll go ahead. And tonight we have with us so far, we have Bill, Leah, and Katarina. And Maggie will hopefully be joining us shortly. I'll go ahead, and what we'll do is I'll ask you guys how we want to do this. Do you want to start off by sort of moving through the text a little bit in order, or do we want to with the questions, or do we want to just sort of start off with some any questions that you guys want to start with? I'm happy to be flexible with what you guys want to talk about this evening.
I think it would be fun to go through the text chronologically, but that's just me.
That sounds fine.
That's fine with me.
Okay, because I do have a question that I want to bring up that Katarina had emailed me that we'll bring up about Herodotus' writing style, what we think about it. So maybe we'll go through the book first, and then we can think about how Herodotus' writing in this book, how it seems to be different from other books as he gets more into the war narrative, how it's similar, what kinds of stories he's bringing in, and what kind of style he's presenting to us. So we want to start at the very back at the very beginning. Where do we start? Where do we pick up? Right? What's just happened in the previous book? Does anybody remember where we are?
The Ionian revolt.
Yes, the Ionians have revolted and they've failed. That revolt.
Yeah.
They failed fairly hard. And so Herodotus is going to go through and sort of give us some little vignettes of various cities and what happens in those individual cities. And some of the most important little vignettes, he brings up obviously the city of Miletus. He brings up Samos and some of the other major players, Argos and Delos. Lade is another one of the cities that gets mentioned. So what do you guys make of Darius's response to all of this and how the Ionian revolt sort of wraps itself up? What do you think, Bill? You want to start us off with some ideas about what's going on?
Well, it seemed to be the start of a discussion of more troubles ahead, I think, with the Persians. And as he starts to paint the scene from city to city, some of which are kind of bleak and some of which are kind of comical. It seems to be kind of like a background narrative for some big thing that's going to happen here. That was my perspective on it.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. What else? What about Leah? What do you think here about what we've got building up here? And how we think maybe this is I think what you're saying, Bill, is that this seems like it's a new pivotal moment where we're sort of building up steam to a new chapter.
Yeah, it's kind of like we're getting ready for round two of something, although you're not quite sure what it is. And I guess really to get to the Battle of Marathon, you're really not sure what happened. But everything seems to be a cumulative effect.
Yeah. I totally agree. I believe that Herodotus' style, it's very foreboding, and it's not a few instances of foreshadowing in here. It definitely seems like he's building up to something, like there's a big point that he's about to make, and especially all this stuff with Miletus.
Katarina, what did you think about our beginning here?
Well, I mean, I was playing catch up from the last call, so I had three books to go through, and I think so that sort of led me to ask the question that I did about the writing style, because I did get the sense, there was a turning point in the story, and like both of them just said, there was this sense of foreshadowing and that something is on the horizon, even though, you know, we know it's going to be another battle of some sort. Because that's just what it's all about anyway.
Yeah.
But, I think, basically, I not that much more to add in terms of that.
Well, Katarina, since you bring this up as part of thinking about this as a transition from the last book into this new thing, what did you make of the style that Herodotus is writing in?
Well, I mean, I've been thinking about that. For me, I feel as if it's difficult to see what the through line is in terms of, let's say, a single event or a character. I think there's mm-hmm. something more vague. I mean, I do think that there's this battle, that continuous battle that goes on, and it's sort of an internal battle and an external battle. I mean, an internal battle in these characters' minds that's sort of projecting out into the world and showing up in these sometimes funny but sometimes gross situations. And they're sort of like episodes. It's very episodic. That was my feeling. So it, sometimes I feel aside from the chronology, he must have had something guiding him through the rest without losing his place, because it's easy to lose your place as a reader. There's just so much information, and the mind wants to grasp onto something, and you can pick up highlights here and there. But I think if you ask four readers, you'll get mm-hmm. four different interpretations of what resonated with them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in some cases, you almost have to go back three or four chapters to pick up the theme of some event or some character mm-hmm. previously had mentioned, and then tie it into the fact that this guy has suddenly appeared back on the stage again.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah.
And why?
Yeah. And
yeah.
And that's the thing, because one of the things that, you know, we sort of, this book is written sort of at the beginning of prose writing, right? And the beginning of writing itself, in terms of people actually writing things so that other people can read it. This is really at an early moment in that development. And so to think of how complex the story is and how complex he the interweavings of what he's doing here, and how you do have to sometimes go, you know, the book divisions are, we don't know if those are original.
Oh.
We don't know if they're original or if they are something that later people who copied the book created when they were sort of putting them into to scroll form and such. So we don't actually know whether these divisions are the original ones. So when you look at something like the narrative of the Ionian Revolt between Book 5 and Book 6, it could have actually been a continual narrative.
Yeah,
whereas when you think about these little episodes, where do they fit in? Because the other thing too, of course, is that publication oftentimes meant going out to the public and reading something. If you tried to read some of this out loud, some of these episodes might take 50 minutes, or maybe an hour, maybe a little bit longer for some of the more detailed episodes. That's about the span of a mm-hmm. listening span, right?
Yes.
Definitely, yeah.
It says the same thing with these tragedies. These tragedies were about an hour and 30 minutes to 2 hours, which is about the length of an average movie, right?
Yeah.
Screenwriter before his day.
Yeah. So if we sort of think about these episodes as sort of things that he might have when he was sort of creating them, that he might have sort of recited or narrated to an audience, and then he sort of, but they're part of this much larger narrative, so that the audience themselves might be seeing them in pieces and parts and not as an entire text. But it's still, you know, he's clearly got to be writing all this down, and he clearly has to be keeping track of this. And when he talks about his researches in that first opening line of the book, but it's clear he's done a lot of his research, right? And he's keeping track somehow.
Yeah, he seems more focused in a way on these certain episodes that leading up to the Battle of Marathon.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I felt anyway as I was reading this is that if we want to sort of think about the narrative that takes us through to the end of the Ionian Revolt, if we sort of think of that as where it would have maybe been a more natural starting point, and then we sort of start thinking about the story of Sparta as its own vignette. And then, of course, we finally will get to Athens and have its own little vignette. And all of it seems to be woven together really by the figure of Miltiades in various ways, who's going to, of course, end up being the big general at Marathon. And the guy who's going to lead it. What did you guys make of, so if we sort of think of it and break it up that way, then it's not as structurally unsound as it sometimes feels.
Yeah.
But we also might want to think about how he fits this. First off, why does he do this focus? On multiple times throughout the book so far, he's done a focus first on Sparta and then on Athens. But at this particular point, he gives us a really long digression on Sparta.
The Spartan kings and the...
Mm-hmm. And he actually gives us what is an ethnographic treatment of the Spartan that is more similar to the kind of treatment he gives to foreign people than to other Greeks. Which is quite interesting if we want to think about how he's positioning the Spartans in this story and how we're supposed to understand who the Spartans are, as it were.
In section 52, he gets into really specifics and sort of near and around section 50 and on, the privileges of the Spartan kings, Spartan customs and debts to the king or state, and if they're forgiven. I thought this was all very, very interesting. It seems this Spartan narrative seemed to flow very well.
Yeah, I sort of felt that as he was wrapping up the narrative of the Ionian Revolt, he starts to pick up his pace a little bit.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
And the text moves a little bit more quickly. At least that's how I felt that this book read a little bit easier than some of the others.
I totally get that. And I think that might be contributing to the sense of foreboding. As he picks up the pace, you start running faster as if there's a giant, like, hurdle coming at you, which is, yeah.
What did you think, Katarina? Did you get that sense as you were sort of, because you powered through quite a few books?
I mean, I can't say that I necessarily got that sense. I felt he was building up some kind of comparative view for some reason. Mm-hmm. I can't say I know exactly what he was doing, to be honest. I don't.
Right.
But I would say one thing I was thinking as I was reading through it was he trying to strike any emotional chords in his reader? I know you said this was the beginning of prose, and, you know, you can plot something out, but then there has to be the sort of the emotional component to the story. And I was wondering if he was giving much thought to any of that when he was just telling these, you know, these details of what was going on. Was he looking, you think, in some way? All of you, I don't know the answer, and I'm curious to know what other people might think.
What do you think, Bill? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I get the impression here in book six that we're at now that we've had comparative civilizations, and now we have the description of the Spartans, which is good, but it seems to cast them into a perhaps a lesser light than some of the other, than the Athenians specifically. It seems like we're headed to perhaps a buildup where events are going to occur to show that the Athenian civilization or group of Greeks is superior to the rest.
Right. Okay. So,
and you get the recurring theme of the gods and the sense of justice and the anti-tyranny and those sorts of things as you go through, and you find these characters all seem to offend the gods by either offending some people or burning the shrines or some combination of the two. Whereas the Athenians so far seem to be coming off pretty easy.
Is this the first book that you'd say you feel he was taking a stance like that? Because I didn't notice that earlier, maybe not as prominently.
I think it was this this particular book where it started to come more into focus? And it could be jumping the gun here. It could be totally wrong, but it just seems to be, you know, as I'm sitting there scratching my head saying, okay, where are we going here? Who's going to be the whitehead guy at the end of this story? That's where he's going. It could be completely wrong, but we'll see in 8, 9, and 10.
Yeah, we'll see, right? Well, I think one of the things we want to think about, though, is what is the, and I think maybe this will maybe get at a little bit, Bill, about what you're seeing here is, what is the focus of his digression on the Spartans? What elements of Spartan culture is he focusing in on? What do the Spartans have that pretty much no other Greeks have? And it's kingship.
Two kings.
I was going to say
they have double the kingship, right? So they have kings, though, right? So there's this concept of monarchy that we sort of have already gotten a vibe about. As he's talking about the Persians specifically, you know, remember back in book one, you know, the Persians have this moment in time where they can either be a free people or they can have a king, and they choose to have a king again. After they, you know, they sort of threw off the yoke of the Assyrians in their ethnography at the very first book. And then they choose to have this guy Deiocase as their king instead of being free. The Spartans have two kings. And I find it interesting, of course, is that the Greeks and Herodotus is sort of representative of this, seem troubled by this, and they see the kings as the source, in some ways, the only or the sort of most prominent. All the Greeks can be corrupted because of greed. Spartan society, as he described to us earlier, is supposed to prevent that, but the kings seem to be vulnerable to it. And it's these kings that seem to be the problem. And that's both the thing that he sees that makes them the most similar to the Persians, which he never accuses any other Greeks really of being similar to the Persians, not even the Thebans, who actually side with the Persians in the war. So I wonder if there isn't something going on here with the actual, where he's sort of, it's a political anomaly, but it's a political anomaly that crosses that line between the way that he conceives or the Greeks generally conceive of the difference between being free and not free. Because I think what we're going to see here is these two kings are, you know, they're corrupt. Clearly Cleomenes is also insane, apparently.
Yeah.
A total package.
Right? He's got the king's madness, right? Remember Cambyses, the king's madness?
Oh my gosh. Throwback
has it, right? But that it's going to take another king to sort of redeem the Spartans when we get to book 7, because of course when we get to book 7 is the big battle of Thermopylae. So we'll have a king redeem the Spartans in some way. But at this particular moment in time, our Spartan kings are the source of corruption for the Spartans, and it's the thing that makes them Persian-like. And Egyptian-like, and I think summoning back up that picture of Egypt and then having poor Cleomenes being cutting himself up and being strapped down so that he can't hurt anyone is sort of giving us flashes of Cambyses as we sort of go through. So I think it's really interesting that you picked up on that, Bill, the sort of negative trending here.
Early political reporting.
They're early political reporting. It's like, what do you think you focus on, right? And then, of course, I love the story that goes along with this, right, is that Demaratus, now that you mentioned this early political reporting, and poor Demaratus, right, has to undergo this political smear campaign against him.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So what can we do to sort of mark him as illegitimate? Is we actually mark him as really, literally illegitimate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's right out of the pages of a modern campaign booklet. Well, if we want to move on a little bit from the digression itself, one of the questions that comes up, and I think this sort of gets to Bill's point, though, is that Herodotus asserts his authorial voice here, and he doesn't do this very often, right? But at 684, when he's actually talking about Cleomenes' madness, he actually takes a stand and says that he thinks he went mad because he unjustly treated Demaratus unjustly. What do we think that actually says here about things like how Herodotus thinks that fate works, or how he thinks that, you know, remember we've got this sort of floating divine retribution thing that goes throughout his work. What do you think when Herodotus inserts his own judgment like that? What do we think he's doing?
Well, earlier in the text, not this particular chapter, but way back in the beginning, he talked a lot about if he didn't know exactly something or another, he was going to proceed with the man who was first to commit an unjust act.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also that talk early, perhaps in the introduction somewhere, where he said it's plain from many pieces of evidence that the hands of gods take action in human lives, and you can see him comment on that all through the text as he comes through. And his comment on this particular guy is he obviously knows that this personal offense took place and that it was supremely unjust to the chap, and consequently, whatever evidence exists, we don't know because he's made up his mind.
You know, it's interesting too, because did you guys notice that our good friend Croesus made a reappearance here in this book? It was
Where
only for a couple paragraphs. It's paragraphs 37 and 38. And it's a really interesting reappearance. And I think, and it might have been you, Bill, it might have been Dwight, though, who back when we were talking about book one actually sort of brought up the issue of Croesus's role and that sort of scene between Croesus and Solon, and how we can sort of think about the story of Croesus as a theme that runs throughout and sort of as guidelines for how we should read the history, right? To never count a man happy till he's dead. And of course, we have Croesus's whole entanglement with oracles, where he sort of misreads oracles willfully. But in the book here, we have this really interesting moment where our friend Miltiades, he gets captured. He's made the tyrant of the Chersonesus. And he gets captured by the people of Lampsacus, and they are going to execute him. But Croesus of Lydia is friends with Miltiades, and so he writes to the people of Lampsacus, and he commands them to release Miltiades. Or he says he will wipe them out as if they were a pine tree.
Oh, wow. I love that.
Okay. And so, and then we have this really funny line from Herodotus. The Lampsacenes who tried to interpret this message were at first bewildered as to why Croesus had used the phrase, quote, wipe them out like a pine tree. But then after much hard thinking, one of the elders came to the realization of its true significance. The pine tree alone of all trees does not produce any new shoots once it has been chopped down, but is utterly destroyed. So Croesus actually acts here as the oracle, and he gives a statement to these people who then have to interpret it. And if they interpret it correctly, they survive. If they interpret it incorrectly, they fail. So Croesus sort of reminds us here of the sort of the fickleness of fate, but also that sort of unknowing moment and his own fate. I just find it really interesting how he's plucked back in here and then acts as an oracle himself in some ways. It's quite an amusing appearance.
Yeah. Katerina, I just wanted to say something also about Demaratus. Mm-hmm. I think that aside from the point on fate, which it seems he's clearly making, or there's a cause and effect to things, I think could be sort of giving an idea of a conscience, that we all have a conscience. And even if you are not totally aware of the repercussions of what you're doing, it still has an effect some way, even unconsciously, I mean, in your actions. So I think maybe he was also trying to, or could have been making a statement about levels of consciousness in the characters and, you know, where they might be at. So,
Yeah, and I think we might think here also about your comment about where Herodotus might be trying to get people to emotionally invest in some ways. And I think one of the things he does is, so Demaratus is, not to spoil your next two books of reading, but three books, but Demaratus becomes an important figure once he makes his way to the Persian court. He becomes sort of, as you say, a conscience. He actually becomes a touchstone for Xerxes. Xerxes asks him about the Greeks. Demaratus tells him the truth. Xerxes doesn't believe him. And then Xerxes pays the price for not believing Demaratus. So Demaratus becomes sort of a wise man figure. And we're supposed to be, we're supposed to invest in him as a character. And I think that's part of what it is that here's one of these moments where Herodotus takes the opportunity to insert his authorial voice to say Demaratus has been wronged. And because he wants us to get on board with Demaratus and think of him as a voice of reason and as a sympathetic voice as we move into the next parts of the book.
That also makes me think, in terms of the characters or in the story itself so far, there doesn't seem to be too much in terms of redemption. And I feel like... I don't know if maybe
<There's no> redemption.
it just seems like everybody's sort of at the whims of fate, and I don't know. I guess maybe there's some kind of a fulfillment that is sort of lacking in some of it, in some of the chapters. I feel up to this point. I don't know if anyone else feels the same way, but yeah, you mentioned redemption earlier, and that's what made me think about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think, Bill?
There seems to be a little forgiveness. My buddy Darius is forgiving a few of the folks that have come his way and asked indulgence. But I agree, there's not much redemption, but there is some forgiveness.
They're trying.
Yeah,
right?
They're trying. Well, I think one of the things that, and maybe we want to keep an eye on this, is that so Demaratus is not the most upstanding of kings himself, but he has been wronged. But I think he will be redeemed in some ways. And Miltiades, the same thing. Though Miltiades, of course, comes to a bad end in our book because he doesn't learn the lesson, maybe, as it were. I think that, remember back at the beginning, that Herodotus talks about how he's going to talk about great and small peoples and cities and things because fate, good fortune never rests in one place for long. We might want to think about whether or not redemption is possible in a narrative where good fortune is seen as or presented as fleeting.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Interesting.
Because I think that implies not just to cities or in peoples, but to individuals as well as part of his narrative. He's often been called a tragic historian. So if you know anything about Greek tragedy, the hero always falls. He doesn't always die, right? He doesn't always die, but
right.
The play often ends with his world sitting in ruin around him for some reason, or her, until you get to Euripides, and then all of a sudden we have happy endings.
But then there's also the argument that the story has its own redemptive value because it's lasted the test of time and it still exists. So maybe the character was no longer alive at the end, but that character's life had some value for everybody else.
Yeah, or what he thought to do.
Yeah, but think about that then in terms of what Herodotus says that what he's doing, right? He tells us at the very beginning he is writing this history, his research is down, so that these great events not be forgotten, because he feels at least that there is some lesson to be learned from all of this and some redemptive value perhaps to the narrative, the full narrative itself, if not for individuals within the story.
Okay.
So if we think about, he's setting up our two main characters here in this book with our Spartans and our Athenians. And let's actually look at our Athenians because they seem to be, first off, for me anyway, they seem to creep up on us this battle of Marathon. It's almost like we're in a movie and you know the big battle is coming, a big battle is coming, because the narrative starts to move a little bit more fast. It's sort of faster, gallopy pace. But then when the battle comes upon you, you sort of, I almost wasn't ready for it. Sort of crept up on me, and then it's this glorious sort of moment, but you know it's only round one of the big battle. It's sort of like if you watch The Lord of the Rings, the Helm's Deep, to what's coming next in The Return of the King. But the but what did you guys think of the way he builds up into the Battle of Marathon and what's going to happen here, how the Athenians are going to sort of come onto the scene here as our great as our great hero for this book. What do you guys think?
They seem to be somewhat favored in that there's some signs beforehand, like the I believe it was the Persian fleet sailing around one of the capes gets just absolutely wiped out. And then we have this battle that follows that, which is a second effort, I guess, on their part. But the part that I find kind of surprising is he doesn't give much discussion to the battle, and the Athenians, in order to win this battle, had to invent a new formation. They had to have a different attack strategy. They didn't know too much about how the Persians worked. He's kind of light on a lot of those details as to how this thing was pulled off, other than the fact that these were very virtuous and decisive people. They were able to come to a wise and quick decision by breaking the vote and then coming up with this ingenious formation that just cratered these guys who have beat everybody on the face of the earth to this point, which is even more remarkable.
And on what seemed to be an fairly open plain, where you think numerical superiority would be a big factor.
Oh, absolutely. And there's no discussion of the use of cavalry, which they were expert in. And he kind of paints the Persians as kind of plodding along and slow, but the Athenians as being wise and decisive. And even though perhaps outnumbered, able to take advantage of their agility and virtue in moving forward. He also makes the point a couple of times that they made the appropriate sacrifices to pick the right time to attack in this battle. So once again, the gods are being appeased somewhat on the Athenian side in this victory.
Kim, what do you think, Leah?
I think the transition from all this stuff directly into the Battle of Marathon is very elegant. And you know, so in the past, Herodotus has been like he's been sort of choppy and skipping around. But I just like to bring up the point again that this is done very masterfully, and I think it is one of the most well-written pieces in the entire thing so far. And then Philippides, is that how you say it?
Well, yeah, it's Philippides, and sometimes he's Pheidippides, so you'll see it both ways.
Okay, I'll say Philippides. And then all of a sudden there's Philippides, and he's like this hero, but he, and it says 6.105. The god Pan fell in with him, and shouting out his name, Philippides ordered him to ask the Athenians why they were paying no attention to him. And I thought this was so cool because Philippides actually gets a direct conversation with a god, and I think that's really cool. That's very very Homeric, if you will.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point to bring up because I think light on the details of what's actually happening in sort of tactically in the battle, but pretty heavy on the Homeric language.
Oh yeah, totally epic.
And so I think that we're, and you know, we've got this, you know, motivational speech that Miltiades gives to Callimachus, you know, to get him to commit, to break the deadlock in the vote. these guys are heroes in the actual real sense of the word. Gods are intervening here personally, and they are walking the walk here of the good old Homeric fighters. Katarina, what did you make of the marathon?
Yeah, I also was surprised at how little attention was given to it, considering the mm-hmm. what it is, you know, that it's a famous battle, and you would think there would be a little more. But in terms of the details he used, also why he chose those details about, you know, waiting for the moon to be full before the troops went in and the dreams and these kinds of things, I thought these were really particular details that maybe you would not have thought of. I don't know. I just thought they sort of made me pause and think, oh, that's sort of interesting. And then how it goes into later on, the suitors and the wedding, it's the whole thing just sort of had a dream-like quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I like that idea of it being sort of a dreamscape in some ways. But it's a shock. I think in maybe some ways it represents the shock of it. Here, all of a sudden, you look up and you've got a huge Persian army on your doorstep. And you, the Athenians, are not well known for being a respectable infantry land army. that's not what you're known for. You're kind of still at this particular moment one of the backwoods cities. You're not Sparta. You're not a military powerhouse. You know, at one point in the book, he tells us that the Athenians, when they were fighting just before this, trying to fight with Aegina, had to go borrow ships from Corinth because they didn't yet have a big enough fleet to deal with mm-hmm. a local battle, right?
Right?
With a local enemy. And yet here they are stepping up, defeating this massive army and doing it in a way. I love Herodotus's description of the battle, where he talks about, let me find the passage here, particularly. Passage 112, of course, is one of the most famous. So the troops are in position, sacrifices have proven favorable, and the Athenians were let loose and allowed to advance. They charge at a run towards the barbarians. The space between the two armies was about a mile, and the Persians, who saw the Athenians advancing toward them on the double, prepared to meet their attack. They assumed that the Athenians were seized by some utterly self-destructive madness as they observed how few the Athenians were in number and how they were charging towards them with neither cavalry nor archers in support. So the barbarians suspected that the Athenians had gone mad. But when the Athenians closed with them in combat, they fought remarkably well. That's sort of an understatement, right? For they were the first of the Hellenes we know of to use the running charge against their enemy as well, as the first to endure the sight of the Medes' clothing and the men wearing it. In fact, until then, even to hear the name Medes spoken would strike terror into Greeks. So he sort of sums up what is the entire battle in this sort of gnomic paragraph about the Athenians' tactics. Why would they charge? What advantage do you get to charging across the field like this? It's not that they're mad. What are they actually doing?
Close the distance.
What do the Persians have?
Your opponent can't use his artillery or his maneuver against you.
In this case, when we say artillery, we mean archers, basically, right? They're going to have. They're known for their archers, so they can't close it. They close the distance fast, so the archers can't adjust and hit them. And then, of course, what are the Athenians wearing that the Persians don't have? Do you guys know what the difference in actual armor is here?
Yeah, they had the overlay armor on the hoplites there, the Persians.
And they're in bronze. They're in metal, right? And they've got these heavy shields. And most of the Persians are wearing leather and linen and have wicker shields
mm-hmm.
and things like this. So you've got fully armed people charging at you at full run. I like this idea of it being sort of dreamlike. And then you sort of fade into it. You have this incredible battle that's in many ways sort of understated. And then you fade out of it into this into the dream of Datis and the image of Apollo left on the ship. It's very strange.
It is. It's almost a moral tale, you know, good over evil kind of episode here. The Persians must have offended us, and therefore we're entitled to this victory.
Yeah, and another thing, just to point out, in case you, I don't know if the I can't remember if they put a note on this. Yeah, they do have a little note on this, but we know, of course, who the 192, that there were 192 people, because there was a monument and their names were inscribed on it that Herodotus could have seen. But it's rather unusual for them to have been buried on the spot. The Athenians treated them as if they were, in fact, heroes, not citizen soldiers. Otherwise, normally you would take the dead home and you would bury them in the cemetery at home. This is an award that was given for, like, hero cult, for Homeric type of heroes. So they were given this really singular, this very singular honor. So for the Athenians, this is a big deal. Just to give you an idea also of how this book, you know, we think of Battle of Marathon, it's often treated as sort of the battle that saved democracy. There was a big, huge thing called, you know, Democracy 2500, the 2500th anniversary of the Battle of Marathon. But it's understated for the Greeks. It's not the big battle. It will become rhetorically the big battle for the Athenians, when the Athenians point back and say, remember that, guys? Remember how we did that all on our own? one of my favorite parts of the story, though, is that the Spartans show up, finally. Right? 3 days later, or whatever. How did the Spartans react to this whole thing?
Just kind of looked around and said, you did a good job, and went home?
Yeah, it's like pat them on the shoulder, good job, Athenians. And then they take off. I just find that so charming.
Well, that was anticlimactic.
That's
an understatement,
right?
Like the Athenians like kick butt, and then the Spartans are like, okay, good job, bye.
Yeah, their contribution was making a massive foot march in a very short period of time, but I guess they were kind of chagrined to show up a day late.
And a dollar short, it seems.
And a dollar short, yes.
Well, I mean, I think this is one of these moments, too. The Spartan response to this is really understated. Perhaps this is a mark that the other Greeks didn't recognize the value of what had happened here. They didn't recognize in some ways that the Athenians had stopped. Something, you know, maybe all the other Greeks just assumed that Darius was just coming to avenge himself on Athens and then would leave the rest of the Greeks alone. Who knows, right? But then we sidle into these other stories after this, and he just sort of lets this hang for a while, and then we're going to come back to the results of this in book 7 as 10 years will pass, and the next big invasion starts coming. But we move into this other story of what do you make of the last bits of the book after the Battle of Marathon? What do you make of this stuff? What would you call it? It has one of my favorite stories of all time from antiquity in it, if you can guess which one it is.
Hold on. Oh, is it, Hippocrates don't care?
Hippocrates doesn't care. That's,
yeah, oh my God, I love that so much. It's literally so funny. I just was, like, sitting in the car on the way to school, like, laughing. Hippocrates don't care.
You should probably assume that a lot of us, classicists and ancient historians, we use that line a lot.
Oh my God, I cannot wait for college.
It's one of the most charming stories. How do we get into this story of this entire bit, right? We have this big battle that we think of as a huge, important battle. It's just sort of sidled in there in this dream state. And then we go into sort of Athenian, Sicyonian politics for the rest of the book.
And they're going to have a challenge to select a select a mate for one of the kings, I think it is here, king's daughters.
Yeah, it's Miltiades, or Clytemnestra of Sicyon. Do you remember, do you guys know from mythology who else his hand, who else held a competition for his daughter's hand?
No.
There's a very famous woman who was won as by a competition of her suitors. It's Helen. Her father, Tyndareus, held a competition.
Oh, right. Yeah,
So I wonder here, right, if we're not supposed, because we had some Homeric language, and then we had a sort of Homeric kind of battle with some heroes, and now we're into a story about a bunch of people who are going to become major players moving forward. Kymon is introduced, Pericles is introduced, like these are their parents, are the guys who are involved in this story. And we've got a contest for suitors, as if we're sort of preparing for what? What happened when when Helen's suitors lost and one guy was chosen, Menelaus? What did they all swear? Does anybody know this story from mythology?
I do not.
No.
They all swear that if anyone steals Helen, that they will band together and hunt them down. So that oath, the oath of Tyndareus, sets the stage for the Trojan War. So we might want to think about whether or not we're intentionally having residences here of the war with Troy, between Troy and the Greeks. Remember how he introduced the whole history, basically, with the snatching of Helen?
Yes.
And Paris? So that maybe we've got some great war, Trojan War resonances happening here to set us up for what's going to be happening as we move forward into books 7 through 9, where we're going to have a massive invasion from a foreign power that is in some ways perhaps a tit for tat, because the Greeks went over for the Ionian Revolt, and now the Persians are going to come back en masse, just as Agamemnon and the Greeks went en masse after Helen at that point. I don't know if it's intentional. I just was always wondering why the story was put in here, other than to amuse us with Hippocrates and his.
Is this all because Darius's servant is reading to him every night at dinner time? You know, reminding him about the Athenians.
Yeah.
To get even with them.
Yeah, but, well, because what did the Athenians do during the Ionian Revolt that really made him angry? Do you guys remember back in Book 5?
That's right. Yes.
They accidentally burned Sardis.
Oops, sorry.
But they contributed to the revolt, 20 ships, and then they sent troops. So Darius is not going to forget that.
Well, Darius is a man of his word. If he says he's going to take care of you, he takes care of you. And if you don't cooperate, he'll take care of you too.
Yeah. And remember, too, we're also have been told multiple times that that Sparta and Athens both killed ambassadors from Xerxes, or from Darius, who came looking for earth and water. So they're on his hit list.
You know, another thing about this part of the narrative is that I kind of felt like life just goes on. There's a war, there's a wedding,
yeah.
There's a death, there's a birth, you know?
Yeah, very full circle.
Well, you know, what's also interesting, if we want to sort of think about some Homeric resonances here, is that in the middle of the great arming scene of Achilles, so Achilles loses his armor in the Iliad, and his mom, who's a goddess, has Hephaestus make him new armor, and there's an extensive description of his shield. And on his shield, half of the shield describes a city at war, and then the other half is a city at peace. And what do you have? You have a battle scene and a wedding. Those are the two things that you have put on the shield. These are sort of emblematic, yes, of peace and war, right? That wedding is sort of emblematic of life going on and moving forward, and of what happens in place of war is you have joy and celebration and renewal. Weddings are sort of like spring all over again for them. And I think it's great, too, because, of course, then you get introduced to the next generation of great Athenians here with the introduction of Kymon and Pericles, who are going to be the two architects of Athens' power moving forward. So very, very interesting stuff. We have a couple of minutes left. do you guys have anything in particular that you just want to sort of bring up that you that we didn't talk about that sounded really interesting to you in this book, or sort of thinking as we move forward into the next book, which is not going to be for a while because we've got a holiday break here coming up. So, what do you think?
Yeah, I'd just love to share one of my favorite stories. Actually, it's at the beginning of book six, but it strikes me as so Greek. It's just unbelievable. It's a section 21. And it's Phrynichus composed his play on the capture of Milo.
Oh, yeah.
Produced it on stage. The audience burst into tears and fined him 1,000 drachmas and like forbade him to ever, you know, produce it again. It's just so funny. No, you can't make us cry like that. We get too emotional.
And I think here, Katerina, we come back to Katerina's question about emotions and emotional investment and sort of things, is that he's talking here about two different responses of two different cities to the destruction of Miletus.
Right.
Right? So first you have Sybaris, whom the Milesians thought of as their closest friends, who don't react at all.
Exactly.
And then you have the Athenians, who have this sort of public mass mourning that they take the destruction of Miletus personally. And so they have this sort of mass catharsis in finding this poet for reminding them of the destruction of Miletus. Where Herodotus is sort of playing with the different ways that you can react, I think, to the story that he's telling. You know, how do these little vignettes fit in? And maybe here's a moment where we're supposed to think about our own, sort of reflect back on our own emotional investment or response in some way.
Yeah, no, that's a thoughtful idea. I mean, I did find myself kind of disoriented in terms of my emotions as I was reading through the different parts of the book. Like, am I supposed to be feeling this way or that way? Or just kind of wondering, what do I feel right now in this moment? And it also
am I supposed to care about this person?
Yeah. But it also made me wonder, you know, he's almost kind of like a New Age philosopher in the sense that you really have to be present in these little episodes, because they're mm-hmm. there and then they're gone. They're there and then they're gone. And it's just, you have to really be invested in that minute when you're reading, or, you know, whatever you're reading at that moment, and then kind of sort of build on it. But you have to be very present reading this book. There's no sort of wandering around.
Yeah, it's like, you know, read a little bit here, put it down, come back 3 hours later.
Yeah, I mean, you have to really orient yourself.
And the characters keep recycling. I mean, you know, 100 pages later, the guy comes back. It's a new episode.
Exactly.
Thank God there are these little footnotes.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And an index, if you can't remember who it is, hit the index up and see.
How on earth did he keep track of all this as he was writing? I mean, I cannot understand what his method was. He wasn't tearing little sheets of paper and writing things down.
Right? A lot of Greek studies.
I imagine him with like his sort of like his intern carrying like these large piles of scrolls everywhere. It's like, hey, can you open scroll six?
Really?
Go back to that one.
How do you edit a book like that?
I know. I mean, I think about, you know, how my own writing process, right? And how everything, you know, how we have computers, and we're, you know, I can't even imagine the days back when we had typewriters, you know, trying to write a book. And I write much shorter books than Herodotus did. But maybe that's part of what we see here, is there is no editing.
Right. That's true.
He sort of writes what comes to his mind. And
stream of consciousness.
Just getting it down on paper is just a massive undertaking. My goodness.
Exactly.
Oh my God.
Right.
And well, being able to read it a week later is even better.
Well, I think we've hit our end time for tonight. This is a really great conversation. I'm really glad you guys had such a good time with the book. This is fun stuff. And of course, now we're getting into the we're getting into the stuff that Herodotus tells us his stories about to begin with, right? We finally are getting into the war between the Greeks and Persians.
Exactly.
So after five, you know, four books of build up, five books of build up, we're finally getting into the big stuff. So I guess let's sign off for the evening, and I look forward to talking about book 7 coming up soon, in a month, I guess.
Yeah, and I'll be done with the college process.
There you go.
Congrats.
Congratulations. Oh, yeah, I'm going to rock book 7 for sure.
Well, you can just figure out how to pay for it.
That's exactly it. All right, well, thank you so much, Rebecca.
Let's not think about that just yet.
One step at a time.
That's right. Get accepted and then move forward.
All right, everyone.
All right. Good night, everyone. Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks, everybody.
Guys. Good night.
Bye.